friends, listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com, worldwide. And we're going to travel down now to a place called Beaufort, which is in South Carolina, a lovely, from what we hear, lovely seaside resort. And we're going to go down to meet with Michael Gerard, and he is actually a Kenny, but he writes under the pen name of Michael Gerard. So now we just need to clear that up, because we know you, and a lot of people from the west of Ireland knew you as a young fella called Gerry Kenny. But not to confuse things too much, tell us about Kilkelly, the village you grew up in.
I will indeed. I will indeed. And I'll tell you first, the reason I'm called Gerry is a great old reason in Ireland. It's because of nicknames. There was another family of Kennys up the street, and they already had a Michael. And once they, my name was Michael Gerard Kenny. My mother quickly decided, if we don't call him Gerard, then he'll be known as Mickey Taylor, because your dad is a tailor, or something like that. She did not want me to have a nickname. Hence, called me Gerard, and obviously it's shortened to Jerry, and that's why I have it.
You grew up in Kilkelly, and as you as you told me before, your father was a tailor, and a well-known tailor in Kilkelly, in County Mayo.
Yes, yes. And you know, as you know, Kilkelly was a very small town. And in the 60s, when I was growing up, it was particularly poor kind of a town. It seemed to be known among the local towns as the hole in the wall. So even the town had a nickname. And so our surrounding towns were regarded as the more well-to-do places, like Charlestown and Swinford and Kelchimach and Ballardreen on the other side. But we had a unique little town there. It's on a big hill with the only businesses of any consequence outside the regular shops and pubs were sand pits. There were several sand pits, because we had a lot of those gravel pits around the area.
Yes,
and other than that, it was just a little town surrounded by small farms. But and all my family, other than us, were small farmers, but we were what's called townies. My father, being a tailor, decided that he needed to live in the town, and the land wasn't big enough of a farm to split between too many people, so he was one of the eight that had to bail out and get another way of making a living, and being a tailor. And his sister was also a tailor. She was a tailoress. His sister, Maggie, my aunt, was also a tailor. And he started out his tailoring business with Tarpey's, who had a shop in the middle of the town. And Tommy Tarpey, that's where he learned tailoring. And, of course, his tailoring then was interrupted by the War of Independence. And he ended up, you know, fighting in that war, in the Ten War, as we call it. But when I was a kid growing up, you know, the wounds of the Civil War and the War of Independence were still fairly raw in that area. I mean, I can remember a lot of testy conversations about things. I was lucky in one sense. My father was well respected. He had acquitted himself well during the war and had survived and had not taken sides in the Civil War. He decided he was not going to take up arms against his own former comrades, and he ended up spending most of the Civil War in the Curragh in Tintown as a prisoner of the Free Sailors. So he didn't have any he hadn't done anything bad to anybody during the Civil War. So I think he was well respected, and because of that, we were well respected.
Where did you fit in the family in terms of siblings?
I was the youngest. I'm the youngest of five. Two older sisters at the top, and then my brothers, two brothers, and then me. And I was the the one that was lucky to make it, because my father was 6 years old when I was born, and my mother was probably 43. So I just about made it. I just about saw the light.
Yeah. And, you know, you were pretty determined, though, like I think a lot of people from west of Ireland, growing up in setting your sights on emigrating.
Yes, I did that early, and I can get into that more detail if you want me to. That's no problem, yeah.
Yeah, no, tell, I want you to tell us about that.
Okay, well, you know, obviously, when I was growing up, everybody did things like go to England for seasonal, like the potatoes and the harvest and things like that. And uncles and all these people, they'd go to England and they'd do that. And, of course, they'd buy the ready-made suits over there, which was killing my father's business, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that was the way it was. But for reasons, I don't know particularly why. I mean, I had an uncle, Mick, who had spent his whole life in Scunthorpe. My mother had been in England and worked during the Blitz herself before she got married. I had other relatives who would go over there, you know, like for the different seasonal stuff. But nobody ever ventured any further. For whatever reason, nobody in my family ever went to America or ever went past England, and some of them actually never went outside the parish. There was quite a lot of my relatives who never went anywhere.
Mm, yeah.
You know?
Which wasn't unusual. Now, growing up, had you you grew up mostly from in '60s?
I was born in '55, so I was growing up in the '60s, and was lucky that free education was just starting to come in, which helped people like us who were poor, because I wouldn't be able to go to college unless I managed to win a scholarship. And my sisters and my brother, older brother, had won scholarships, and I probably might have been able to make one, but I didn't have to. So that took that pressure off me. And after Kilkelly National School, I went to St. Patrick's, Colossus Borick in Swinford. That's where I did my intermediate and leaving cert there in Swinford.
Yeah.
And school buses came in at that stage. And, you know, so I was lucky. Me and my older brother, Tom, were lucky that we had that opportunity.
Yeah, you were spoiled rotten, if you ask me. But that's
yes, probably was. Probably was.
No, I say that tongue-in-cheek, obviously. But you're actually, for the benefits of it, that was not a bad time to be you know, born and raised in that area, because previous to that, the likelihood of getting into college or high school and boarding schools and onto university, but that was, you know, a luxury of the rich, nobody firing around, you know, the whole concept of scholarships wasn't even that common. But you had decided then that somehow you had your sights set on America, not on England, on Australia.
Well, that was sort of a family situation, really, because, as I told you, my father was in the old IRA, in the East Mayo Brigade, and, you know, he was one of those freedom-winning warriors that wasn't very much appreciated in those times, you know, and got a paltry little pension out of it, and tailoring was no good, so there wasn't any money. But and then, of course, he died suddenly in 1969 when I was 13, and that changed my life in many ways. And on the immigration front, I had listened in to, you know, the regular meetings that some of the old IRA comrades would have in our tailor shop, because unfortunately they were all dying off, and they would always get together for funerals. and I'd listen in and hear their stories. But I always, I used to question my father about it, and we used to take long walks on a Sunday, and I'd question him about how many tens he killed and all that stuff, and of course he didn't want to talk about it. But he did admit to the regret of not having immigrated to America like a lot of his comrades had done. And I was keenly aware of that regret, and I don't know, I didn't plan it, but whatever happened, but when we buried him, the only thing I could think of saying at the grave, I couldn't pray, I was a bit too, I was grieving too much or whatever, in shock, but I said to him, I promised him, I'll go to America for you. And basically, that stuck in me, and I never let that go. And I always had that in my mind. And even through, you know, times when I didn't think I'd make it, I never let that dream go. And that probably sustained me for many years.
Yeah. How did that lead to a career? And maybe you'll just tell us where that came from.
Well, I mean, obviously, I went to secondary school, and just around that time, you were getting things like these polytechs were starting to come up, and, you know, I suffered from the fact that having lost a father at an important time in my life, I didn't have maybe the control and direction. My mother was struggling to take care of two wild teenagers during those years. And I probably didn't do as well in secondary school as I should have, to be quite honest about it. And I decided, I had gone to school very young because of my birthday being in July, and I actually did my leaving cert when I was 16, which was quite young for most kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my brother Pat at the time, who knew your brother in the hotel business, he was working in London at the Hilton in Hyde Park. And I was desperate to go somewhere. And I convinced him to sort of like take care of me if I could get myself over to England. And my uncle Ned was going to Scunthorpe to do some seasonal work. And I had no interest in going to Scunthorpe. I had no interest in picking potatoes. But I wanted to go to London. And so we parted at Crewe. And I went to London, and my brother met me at King's Cross, and I got a start in the buildings quite soon. Because, you know, I grew up, even though I was a townie, I did lots of haymaking because there was no money around. So we did haymaking, my brother and I, and turf and putting in turf. So I was used to work. I could work. So I was, even at 16, I was able to show these gangers and these places that I could shovel concrete all day, or I could do whatever they need to do, and I got a start in the building and loved it, and overstayed my welcome to the point where I missed the chance to go on to college for that year and didn't come back until, late autumn that year, because my mother was begging and pleading for me to come back. And so I sort of missed the boat in that sense, and then we decided I didn't really have the money to afford to go to college, to pay my way in Galway to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And so I then decided to work for a year to get the money together. And I came up with a clever plan, if maybe a little dubious at the time. You know, I had worked during my summer holidays when I was like going to high school, because my brother was in the hotel business, like I said, and at that stage he was down working in Blarney in Cork area, and I used to go down and work in Hotel Blarney for a month or two of those summers. So I knew how to pull pints, I knew how to serve tables, I knew that stuff already, and I thought to myself, well, I get a job as a barman. And so I investigated it, and we found out that the place to go was Dublin, that's where the best money was going, but if you were a trainee barman or an apprentice, you got hardly anything. But if you were a qualified barman, you got into the union and you got real money.
There you go.
So I went, my mother and I went and had a chat to a local publican in Kilkelly that I won't name, who was able to furnish me with a reference to say that I had 3 years of bar experience. And I was able to go to Dublin with that and walk right into a senior barman job in a workman's pub in Dublin, and I was able to make decent money and save quite a lot of money over the next year so I could pay my way in college. So I guess I was scheming from an early age, and it was honest scheming, but, you know, I had to do it in order to get by. And so I went to college and studied chemistry in Galway, and then went on to Cork and studied chemical engineering, and then started that job in Roadstone. That was my first job, as I mentioned to you when we talked one time before, in a place you know well, in Mungret. And hated the job. Hated the routine, hated the stink of the place, hated everything about it. And then, again, life is full of chance meetings. I had a chance meeting in a bar, above all places, in Limerick, with a man with the same last name as me, who said, I'm looking for a salesman to sell chemicals. You think you'd like to do that and get out of this job that you don't like? And I said, I'll go for it. And there was a car thrown in, and I had never had a car before. In fact, I couldn't even drive properly. So I had to fudge that as well. But anyway, long and short of it, I secured that job, secured a car, figured out a way to get it out of Hill Start and get out into the open, and took off from there and found that I was a very good salesman, and started my selling career from that point.
Let me ask you, Michael Gerard, about now you arrived in Beaufort, which again is a little seaside town. Would it have reminded you, say, of places like Enniscrone, which I'm sure...
I think it would have reminded me, because remember, I had lived in Cork. It reminded me more of Kinsale. It's a lot like Kinsale. It's on a bay. It's a lovely old historic city. It's the second oldest city in South Carolina after Charleston, founded in 1711. So it's an old city with a very, very, very long history. Very interesting place. Now, we had come first to Columbia, South Carolina, which is kind of center of the state. Didn't appeal to us very much. And luckily, this is the first time in my life I could make a decision about where I wanted to live. And I knew I was going to be on the road anyway. So my wife was a legal secretary, and so we knew she could get a job anywhere with an attorney. And she was working with some legal people up in Columbia. And so we said, well, let's have a look around. And I was already traveling around, you know, trying to do deals. And I came back and I said, you know, I found this lovely old town down near Charleston called Beaufort. And Charleston's very nice as well, but I don't know if we could afford it. Let's go down and have a look. So we went down the following week and had a look around Charleston. And the only thing we could afford in Charleston was, like, houses that were right on top of projects and things like that. And we weren't comfortable about that. And then we came down to Beaufort and we found we could get more for our money, and cut a long story short, we met a lady that day who was a real estate agent. She showed me an old house. A few months later, I bought that house, and I'm still in it right now, and this is the house that I'm in, built in 1870, out of wood. Still have the original windows, one of the few real basements in Beaufort. Lovely old house, and I'm very fond of it, very fond of it.
Machinery.
Yes.
Even though the company is called Sand Science, tell us about the machinery, because that's where you made the bid.
Now, like I say, we were selling equipment to quarries and mines and those kind of places, and have, over the years, have expanded into skip loading conveyors and wood processing equipment for the industries that's down around here, and composting and recycling and all that kind of stuff. And we carry a whole range of equipment in that line and a rental fleet. And luckily, my two sons have got involved in the business with me now. So my wife does the books, so my two sons sell with me. And we've got several other employees that help us fix these machines. And we've got a nice, solid, profitable business that is going on and will go on after my time.
You started off writing, am I right, in the basement of your 1870 house, and that's where we're reaching you right now. Where did the writing bug come from?
Well, way back when I was in secondary school, I liked to doodle and write little bits, a few lines of poetry and stuff like that. And one time in secondary school, I won a prize for a composition. You know the way they give us competitions in those days?
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
They said we have to do this composition in Irish about the school clock. And I went off on a total tangent, and my story was I was the school clock. And so I'm looking out at the people coming and going, and they loved it. And I won a prize, and my prize was the work of Percy French that I still have today.
Wow. How about
and
that?
And so, but then life got in the way, you know? I mean, we had young kids, and I had a business to grow and stuff like that, and I didn't nearly get round to having time to write until, again, circumstances come about. And back in the 90s, when my kids were young, in our local paper one day, I happened to see a little article about a fella with a great name called Brewster Robinson, who was doing a creative writing class here locally. And I thought, it works out for me. This is done on a Tuesday night or something like that. I'm usually around on a Tuesday night. So I went to his class. And in the first class, he said to everybody, I want you to start a work tonight, and you finish it during this period of classes. It can be a short story. It can be a poem. It can be a novel. You decide what. But I want something in the next week that will get there and do that. And I went home and brainstormed and thought about it and what to do. Remember, I just left Africa, and I had been working with the diamond mine and the gold mine and things like that, and I started hatching a story on all of that stuff, and that's when I started writing the book that ended up being my first novel, which was The Kimberley File, about an adventure story about a particular unfortunate or fortunate Irishman salesman in South Africa who ended up getting entangled with illegal diamonds, and you can draw your own conclusions from that.
Yeah,
but that was my first book. It was a bit raw, but it taught me that I could write a book, and I could finish a book, and I could publish a book. So I solved a number of problems with that one, and of course then years went by. And the book that was stuck in my head for all the years was the book that turned out to be my second book, which was the Ireland's Final Rebellion. That goes back to my father's situation, goes back to all of that. And I couldn't figure out how to tell that story. And, you know, I spent probably 15 years working on that book on and off because I didn't know, I couldn't find a voice. Couldn't find the voice to write it. And again, perseverance always works out in the end. Eventually found that voice and eventually became that two-part book, second part being My American Dream, because I had to tell that story, had to get that off my back, because that was haunting me, that promise to my father, that whole situation that I grew up in. Was I had to tell that story about ordinary soldiers like my father who, you know, put their life on the line, got very, very little for it. You know, Collins and De Valera and people, they got all the glory. But these little foot soldiers like my father and all the rest of them, people like we talked about before, you know, like,
you could actually,
they got nothing but a paltry pension.
I know. You could add Jack Byrne, your neighbor, to that as well. And there were a number, the George Harrison from Kilkelly.
John Lee was a great name.
That's right.
Eddie Boland from Swinford. There was all these kind of people that used to come to our house for these meetings, you know?
Yeah, and there, many of them with Kilkelly roots are actually have a book. The next one, which doesn't sound, the title, that does not give the impression that this is a story of, the Irish of Alicante. I had to look up and see where it is. See, I didn't
Yeah.
I didn't do too well in geography in Ireland. Where's Alicante?
Alicante is on the southeast Mediterranean coast of Spain.
Oh.
Now, how this came about was this. When I was doing my research and writing The Final Rebellion, I kept coming across the role of the gentry, the landowners, both Catholic and Protestant, in the fight, in the good fight, in the events, in the land wars. That was all part of the research I was doing. And it was bugging me, and I thought, you know, I'm going to be told there. And it just didn't fit in with the book I was doing, because the book, The Final Rebellion, was to do with, you know, our good fighters, our people, like my father and Michael Corcoran and all those people that were doing it. So I had to put that to one side. And I was saying to myself, you know, maybe I'm one of these people where an idea gets in your head and won't go away. And it was there, and I was trying to figure it out, what to do. Because, you know, I don't come from any aristocracy. I didn't know anybody who was aristocracy. I probably couldn't have spelt that word way back. And so I didn't know how to present that side, that perspective to the story. And then about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I was at home in Mayo visiting everybody. And my sister Mary and her husband Todd, we went out for a drive one day. And I said, well, where are we going? They said, well, we'd like to show you this place called Moor Hall. And I said, that sounds interesting. And we went over to Moor Hall on Lake Carra. It's only a few miles from Castlebar. And that place just blew my breath away. It took my breath away. It's just an enchanting place right there. And this old ruined house is sitting there on the edge of the lake. And, you know, I read the gravestones and read a little bit and found about more about it. And the more I read, the more intrigued I was about the story. And then suddenly the light went on in my head and saying, this is it. This story is speaking to me. This is the way that I can tell that other side of Irish history, that other perspective of Irish history,
right,
about the gentry, about the Protestants and the Catholics and the landowners, because they have a story to tell too. They have an integral part in the formation of the modern Ireland, and their story needs to be told. So therefore, I started researching that a bit more, and then I found out in that research that the Moors, you know, were Protestants that were planted into Mayo way back in the 1600s, 15 and 1600s, and just didn't do anything in that land until another relative who fought at the Battle of the Boyne on the Protestant side, and after that was rewarded with more land in Mayo to add to the land they already had, and then they went and built a house and set up a thing called Ashbrook Estate in Strad, of all places, in County Mayo.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning of that Moor family. But then they brought in the penal law. And what happened was, by the time the penal laws came in, the Moors had succumbed to the Irish women, like so many of the settlers, and had become more Irish than the Irish themselves. And so the current landlord of the Moor estate in Strad had married one of the Lynches from the tribes of Galway and had changed to being a Catholic. And so then they brought in the penal laws, and that changed the whole ball game. And George happened to be the second son, and the second son doesn't get anything, you see. The oldest son inherits the land. And so him and his mother tried to hatch a plan, and the plan was, she had family, because remember, the tribes of Galway were great merchants going back hundreds and hundreds of years. And after those people, they were all involved in the Jacobite Wars, and after the Siege of Limerick and the Treaty of Limerick and all that stuff, they all got banished out of the country, what became known as the Flight of the Wild Geese that we all know about from history. And so she had a lot of relatives in France and Spain who were merchants. And so her and young George got together and came up with the plan that he would go over to Spain and under the wing of some of their relatives and learn how to be a merchant. And that's why he went to Alicante, because they needed him in Alicante. And he was very successful there, ended up with his own fleet of ships and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, wow.
But there's very little detail about that. So I had to get creative. I knew that he had gone to Alicante in 1754. I knew he'd been very successful in his own fleet of ships, and I knew he came back and built Moor Hall. That's all we knew. I had to construct his business plan for him to make him the successful person that he became, because there was no historical evidence of it. There was nothing ever written down about it. And
you
so I had to...
Still cheeky, were you? Yeah.
You know, I had to write his business plan and his success story and bring him back to Ireland in 1790s and built Moor Hall, and then it took off from there, because I already knew that his first son, who had been born in Spain, John, he got involved in the 1798 rebellion and met up with General Humbert in Killala. And got all into that. He was into the Wolfe Tone and the Irishmen, and he ended up being appointed the first president of a republic in Ireland, being the president of Connacht, and lost his life in that rebellion. And so they had started already on a nationalist path. And so I began to realize that, gosh, these Moors have a very interesting history, and it goes down through. And I researched it and filled in the gaps and everything like that. And I brought it right down to 1923, when Moor Hall was burned by the IRA. Very interesting history. And they were very true blue Irish people in lots of ways. They were Catholics, but they struggled, different ones of them struggled between which side of the fence to go, because, you know, there's good opportunities going. You're like a cow, you eat the green grass on whichever side of the fence is there. And so they were very interesting people, and they were involved in nationalism. They were involved in horses. George Henry Moore, he was the third George Moore, was a great horse trainer and won the Chester Cup and used that money to feed the starving people. So their history was just so rich, and it just was a great vehicle to tell that story of our people and their people, and how the whole thing melds together, and how we got down the line gradually to the land wars. And isn't it very ironic that Michael Davitt came from Strait, and he comes into the story much later on, and Captain Boycott and all that stuff. And there was just so much great stuff there that it had to be a book. And the thing that surprised me the most, Adrian, was that nobody ever wrote this book before, because it's a great book. And other than little bits and pieces that have been written over the years, nobody put it all together until I came along, that I ever found out about anyway.
The book itself. Now, how do we go about ordering the book, getting the book? And again,
in the past week, I finally got everything squared away. Enda Kenny to endorse the book. Enda, he's a Kenny, but he's not related to me, but God bless him, I know him well, and he knows us, our family, and Enda agreed to my endorsement, so he was my last endorsement that I was looking for, so I got that squared away, and your good self, and another good author down here that also agreed to endorse the book. You've got Amazon.com books. And put in The Irish Merchant of Alicante, I've tried it myself, by Michael Gerard, it's come right up. Or another route is go to my website, which is www.michaelgerardauthor.com, and there's a direct link to Amazon from that website, and you're right there again, and you see my three books.
I want to thank you for spending the time with us, and you know how to tell a story, that's for sure. But then, didn't your father's, your great grandmother, through
the Shanachie,
the Shanachie, and Shanachie is an Irish storyteller, but not any old storyteller. Shanahi has great talent in spinning a story, and it's very Irish.
Yes. Don't,
it's been great speaking with you, and again, very interesting, and your writings and your story. And I'm sure that we should indeed also let our listeners know about your last book, actually, Ireland's Final Rebellion, 1919 to 1921, and then two for the price of one, and American Dream. So you have two.
Yeah, two. It's all in one book. It's all actually in one book.
That's in one book.
Yeah.
And is your first book, The Kimberley File, is that still...
Kimberley File. That's right on the website as well, on Amazon, and it's totally different. Because the other two are historical novels, that's an adventure story, totally different.
So you have been listening, and you are listening to Irish Radio Network USA. My guest, Gerry Kenny, who is actually Michael Gerard Kenny. Author, and again, if you would like to hear this interview or portions thereof, or for that matter, any interview that we've done over the centuries, to go to irishradio.com and hit our archives page, you should be able to find it.